Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Environmental Studies channel of the New Books Network podcast. I'm Padmapriya Vidya Govindarajan, and I'm thrilled to host my very first interview on this channel with Professor Julie Z about her extremely prescient book, Environmental Justice in a Moment of Danger, published in 2020 by UC Press. Professor Julie Z is a professor of American Studies and founding director of the Environmental Justice Project at the University of California, Davis. This is her third book, and she works on issues of environmental justice, public policy, and social movements. I'm excited to have you on this podcast, Julie.
Thank you for the invite.
Yeah, so especially since this book was written in 2020, and at the really early moment of the pandemic, I'm hoping that we can talk about and introduce the book to our listeners, but we can also reflect on the last 2.5 years since the book and include some of your reflections on the reception of the book, as well as how you think about the arguments you put forward at the moment of publication, if that's okay with you.
Yes, there's a lot to think about. So I wrote this book as a primer that was meant to introduce concepts from American studies and ethnic studies and sort of transnational critical studies around gender and indigeneity, you know, academic concepts with the social movements that many people are very familiar with. For example, Flint, Michigan, or Standing Rock, and different kinds of hurricanes. And what I wanted to do is have a way to synthesize, to describe the movements and the actions, but also connect them to each other, because we're in this moment where there is both a lot of knowledge of environmental injustice and environmental social movements, more than I think, you know, ever in the career that I, you know, have been working on this for 30 years. At the same time, there's such a relentlessness that it's hard to sort of take a step back and say, okay, well, how are these things connected? You know, what is happening really? You know, what's the big picture? So I wanted to kind of zoom in into specific moments that I think were kind of iconic, but also have a big picture, overview of how that these struggles are linked, in part because social movements were and are always doing these linkages themselves. So, you know, there's a lot of academic work that, and sort of terms like racial capitalism or extractivism. And, you know, I wanted to do a kind of explanation, a primer for people who are not, you know, in academia, but, you know, interested in movements and so on. And so the structure of the book is really focused on keywords and case studies, and makes an sort of overall argument about the centrality of environmental justice movements in our moment of danger. The chapters, you know, outline, it's pretty simple. The first chapter, and each chapter is also anchored by kind of a network or a coalition. So the first chapter looks at Standing Rock, and, you know, oil, indigenous movements against oils and oil extraction and pipelines, looking at the indigenous environmental network and, you know, these key terms of kind of settler colonialism and so on. The second chapter looks at activism and the violence in places like Flint, Michigan, and also the Central Valley region of California, where I'm based, and thinking about these ideas of sort of slow violence and fast violence, the politics of privatization and neoliberalism, and the resistance to those. And the third chapter introduces this idea of a non-naive radical hope. Opens with, you know, Hurricane Katrina, I think that Hurricane Katrina in a lot of ways kind of opens up this moment that we're kind of like really living in. I mean, you can argue about what the start point of various, you know, things are. But for me, Hurricane Katrina was definitely like this moment where a lot of people who hadn't really thought, not the people who had been living the kind of racial violence or environmental pollution and toxicity, but, you know, sort of the broader, you know, community of people who weren't directly impacted. Hurricane Katrina was kind of that, like, wow, you know, the US government will just let people die, you know, let poor people, Black people, old people just die. And there was that kind of moment of shock, which, you know, from 2005, which now in a lot of ways, like a lot of people aren't surprised in the way that, you know, it kind of felt surprising in 2005 for some people, again, not the people who had always been experiencing it. But I used Hurricane Katrina as kind of this opening salvo. I also talk about Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. But I wanted to talk about, you know, violence and spectacle disasters, but not leave it sort of the, you know, as like a grim tale of, you know, this is inevitable or this is about decline. So that chapter is really looking at the politics of climate justice movements and so on. So that's the kind of, then the anchor organizations for the two middle chapters, the Flint one and the Central Valley is looking at, I look at Community Water Center, which is an organization in Visalia in California that really works on water justice issues. And the third chapter looks at UpRose and climate justice movements in New York City. So so that's the kind of arc, and the intention of the book was a kind of book where people could, you know, pick it up and give it to somebody who's kind of interested in these topics and sort of trying to understand. You know, I opened the book with some music as well. I opened with a Stevie Wonder song, but at some point I talk about Marvin Gaye, you know, that song, What's Going On. And so the role of culture and storytelling is a very important part of the arguments of the book. But the book, to for me, is kind of a primer for people trying to understand, like, what's happening? You know, why is this happening and what's being done about it? And really foregrounding the important work that environmental justice movements and justice movements more broadly have been doing to basically resist the structures of settler colonialism, white supremacy, violence, and so on. So that was the aim and the intent. Of course, you know, this book came out in 2020 and COVID just magnifies, you know, the problems that the book talks about. So, you know, we've seen that, you know, the exposure to poor, bad air quality leaves people more, and people of color and poor people more vulnerable to deaths from COVID and so on. In some of the work that I've done with Jackie Leung and Vivian Shaw, we're writing a piece on Marshallese diaspora Pacific Islanders who have the highest rates of COVID. And they are, their homelands have been erased, are being currently wiped away from sea level rise in the Marshall Islands, and also decades of US military testing. So their homelands are already, you know, bombarded by nuclear contamination, vulnerable to sea level rise. You know, their homelands, you know, that's why they're in the US. And then because of the sort of labor markets and segmentation, you know, they have the highest rates of COVID. In Oregon, certainly, and the Pacific Islanders more broadly have the highest rates of COVID. So, you know, COVID just magnifies these injustices and these inequalities. And what I think one of the big lessons from environmental justice movements is that, you know, everything is connected. There is no separation between environmental, social, or racial justice and injustice. And the biggest lesson, you know, that I always take from environmental justice movements is that the fight is what is really central. It's about, like, rejecting the nihilism and the cynicism, which it's very easy if you follow sort of the climate science to kind of fall into pits of despair. So that's why the book really wanted to end with this idea of hope, but not in a sort of, you know, techno utopian, like we'll find a techno fix and everything will be fine. We can just get back to a new normal. You know, we've talked about this, you know, with COVID, like, you know, what does the new normal look like? What is the recovery? Well, you know, justice movements say it's not what it was. That's not justice. You know, we want to remake things in a different model that rejects the institutions and the hierarchies that we have already been living and dying under. So I don't know if that gets to what your questions were.
No, thank you for that. That is such a capacious summary, and it really gets into the heart of several issues that you raise in the book. And your book, like you're saying, it's such a remarkable and it's such a thoughtful appraisal of environmental justice. And it's wonderfully readable. So it's good to know also that you envisioned your audience to be somebody who can pick up the book if they want to learn about environmental justice and learn about environmental justice in its most intersectional form, where people come together and think about these issues across the spectrum of what can be considered environmental justice. So thank you so much for that summary of the book. If I could maybe then probe you a little bit on sort of this non-naive hope that you're talking about, right? This politics of hope that you're offering, mm-hmm. It's wonderful and it's radical. And I wonder what it is that you ground that hope in, especially since you point to the amount of data that we're inundated in and all of these toxic stories and stories of violence and environmental violence. Where is your politics of hope grounded in then? Where does one ground that non-naive politics of hope?
For me, the grounding in the hope is in the resistance struggle. So, you know, this is kind of a social movement's question, which is how successful are the social movements? And one way to measure them is, do they win on the campaigns that they're fighting on? You know, and, you know, to be perfectly honest, a lot of the environmental justice, you know, organizations do not win. You know, they quote lose more often than they win. But I don't see that as the metric, in part because it sets such a high bar for what success is. And so, you know, and when all of the institutions and power structures are like, you know, tipped against them. Do you know what I mean? I think it's really unfair to be like, okay, well, they're only successful if they win on, you know, rejecting every, you know, campaign, you know, if they win every campaign they fight for, you know? And so for me, you know, I think about the continuing fight, you know, and the rejection of despair as the hope itself. And so, you know, if you look at climate justice movements, there is so much creativity and culture and the youth movements in particular that use like satire and storytelling to sort of change the culture and the consciousness, the kind of hearts and minds, you know, argument. And I think that's where I, you know, whenever I start to sort of go into my pit of despair, you know, I think about the young people who are rejecting, you know, the idea that there is no future. You know, I mean, there's a lot of emerging research saying that young people don't want to have kids because they can't imagine a future. And my colleague Sarah Jaquette Ray wrote a book called Field Guide to Climate Anxiety, where she talks about how in her environmental studies class, you know, a lot of the young people literally can't imagine a future. You know, they're just like stuck in, they get mired in a sort of, you know, apocalyptic depression. And, you know, there's no hope. You know, but I think there's a lot of people who are making this argument that, you know, cynicism and nihilism, you know, that is actually very political. So if you kind of defang people's ability to organize because everything's like game over, you know, guess what? That benefits, you know, it benefits the existing power structures to keep the societies, you know, running the way it is. Do you know what I mean? And so where I get hope is in, you know, young people saying, you know, no, we reject that. You know, we reject your model of, you know, that it has to be like this. And, you know, it's young people. It's also Indigenous people saying, look, you know, this is where, you know, social movements like, you know, the Indigenous principles of just transition, you know, or the Black Lives Matter, you know, statements about the Green New Deal, you know, their vision is so capacious. And so it's not just like, okay, well, we need, you know, society to look like the way it is, but just be not gas-based. Like if we had a solar version of the current society, you know, there's a line of thinking that says, okay, well, that's a good transition, right? That's a carbon transition. And there are justice movements, environmental justice movements that say, no, that's not actually the goal. you know, we don't want just like a solar version of the society we live in now. Do you know what I mean? So what are the models that we look at for what that society looks like? And so for me, you know, a lot of the work I've done the last 2 years since the book has been written has been, you know, thinking about climate justice, just transition. Movement Generation, which is a collective based in Oakland, has this remarkable set of principles of just transition, where oil is one component of the extractivism. You know, it's the most obvious, and it's the one that people understand, but it's also about how we value caring and economy and sort of social relations. And so I think, you know, that I'm very compelled by that vision as well. So that's to me where the non-naive radical hope is. It's from Black and Indigenous people and young people who are saying, you know, not only are we not okay with the way things are, we actually have a vision of how we want it to be. You know, non-hierarchical, not based on individualism, based on solidarity, and so on. So,
thank you. That's such a wonderful place to locate your hope in. And I think one of the most hopeful parts of the book that you talk about is in your invocation of these cultures of solidarity. And while you say that you end on this note and you end on these cultures of solidarity and offer this politics of hope, I think you also draw on it and weave it throughout the book, which was very beautifully done. Like in the very first chapter, you draw on Robin Kelly's definition of solidarity and solidarity as made in struggle. And mm-hmm. in this process, you kind of revisit this as a key theme throughout your book. And like you say, in imagining together this process of another world existing, and you say, however temporarily, in your summation of in your summarization of Standing Rock. And so I wonder if you could speak a little bit more to that. What are the key components that emerge as crucial to this imagination and this coming together? And what is the temporality of such a solidarity in the context of environmental justice?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, that idea of the solidarity and the radical politics and the kind of, you know, the things kind of come up and then go back down. And, you know, you've seen a lot more of this, you know, during COVID, like many more people are understanding what, you know, the politics of mutual aid or food, you know, food justice look like in terms of, you know, community free fridge and, you know, kitchens, that kind of stuff. I think that, you know, for me, I'm guided by what the movements do themselves. So, you know, in the book, like there are, you know, coalitions that go from, you know, Flint to Standing Rock, you know, and then to people who the movements themselves are heavily, heavily networked. You know, and so the water justice people in, you know, California are talking to folks in Michigan and so on. So, you know, in some ways what I'm doing is just reporting or recounting what's happening on the ground, you know, and those are beautiful moments that have deep meaning. And, you know, folks coming from Palestine to, you know, have solidarity with folks at Standing Rock and so on. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think one of the things that, you know, I don't really talk about this like in the book, but one of the things I'm trying to think about is like what the desire for power and domination, like, you know, come from. And part of it has to do with like control and sort of top down, you know, hierarchy. And so, you know, this different model, this decentralized like temporariness, it's kind of like, you know, the politics of Occupy and so on. But like it's less about control and, you know, there's a single leader or there's a single, you know, visionary and so on. And so, you know, like the Climate Justice Alliance, and then there's different climate justice networks, they have this like idea of like many marbles in a bag, do you know what I mean? As opposed to like mm-hmm. one big, like this is the thing that everybody goes, you know, for, do you know what I mean? But that like, it has to be local, contextual, and so on, but that there's strength in the sort of many, the many local struggles as well. Do you know what I mean? And so for me, that's where a lot of the solidarity comes in. It's like understanding that these things are temporary, they're contextual, they can come together and then sort of dissolve. You know, there's a little bit of an impermanence, you know, to it, which, you know, it's a different model of like relating and sort of like building long-term, you know, institutions that kind of hold onto their power, you know, but it is a power as well. It's a power, and you know, and you could get the metaphor too from like, you know, literal power, you know, in energy systems. Instead of having like a gigantic nuclear power plant, you know, it's like many decentralized, you know, community-based solar panels or something. Do you know what I mean? Or like, you know, somebody told me once that you can actually like harness the energy from kids running in a back in like an elementary school. Do you know what I mean? Like that can power schools too. Do you know what I mean? And so like, you know, energy is not just a metaphor, you know, it's actually like a practice. And like our energy system's like, you know, big and dominating as opposed to like many, you know, many little parts. Do you know what I mean? But the little parts are actually stronger, you know, as a whole. So I think that's what I'm very interested in too. So.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. This, where it's very much about imagining and the possibilities that exist within imagining, not necessarily sustaining it in a particular way or it taking a particular form that adheres to these existing structures of power and these existing structures of domination. And I wonder though, if at this moment we can think a little bit about what you conceptualize as a moment of danger, because you're thinking and you point to these moments of danger and you very much point to this idea of like big things like a hurricane or disasters as you conceptualize them. But you also talk about a solidarity, a sense of community and imagination that is a long time in the making. So I wonder if then we could speak to what these moments of danger are and how they're experienced by these people through everyday processes and how these alternate imaginings are sustained through the sight of the everyday, which kind of seems to be implicit in all of your chapters.
Yeah, and that's why it was very important to start with Indigenous struggles for environmental justice. And, you know, I mean, I am an American studies professor. I'm grounded primarily in the US, but, you know, and of course, environmental justice is a transnational movement. It has been from its founding. I mean, depending on when you find the founding, but it's always been, you know, in solidarity with, you know, groups in South Africa and Brazil and so on. So the US is, you know, the environmental justice is not a US only, but it's the part that I'm most familiar with is the US centered environmental justice who are always deeply transnationally networked. But the environmental justice movement has always been, you know, the Indigenous voices have always been front and foremost to that struggle. And I think for me, you know, coming from the US and, you know, I know it's different in different places, but, you know, Indigenous voices and African-American voices, you know, live and continue to live and thrive even when the systems in the US around settler colonialism and, you know, afterlives of slavery, you know, basically demand or, you know, their active death and, you know, denial of their, you know, what Kyle White, Indigenous philosopher, calls like collective continuance, the right to survive, the right to live, the right to thrive. You know, everything in the US historically and, you know, institutionally has been structured around the, you know, the taking of land from Indigenous people and the taking of labor from African Americans. And, you know, if you, you know, communities of Indigenous and African American people have struggled like from the very moment, you know, and some could say environmental justice is as old as 500 years. You know, that's what the principles of environmental justice say, you know, for 500 years, you know, I think that's like in the preamble. Do you know what I mean? So some could say, and some argue that environmental justice is a 500-year-old movement. And so, you know, centering the voices of Indigenous people and African-American people, you know, who continue to live and survive and thrive and create, you know, that's where I get my hope from. Because, you know, as a person who is, you know, descended from immigrants, you know, and working class people, you know, I mean, I have a different relationship, you know, to this. And so part of it is understanding, you know, as a descendant of, you know, a working class, you know, immigrants who had their own, like, you know, traumas politically and so on, you know, people don't come to the US like without their own politics and, you know, traumas and so on. But, you know, for me, understanding what the struggles are and what the stakes are, as somebody who was born in the US and has US citizenship, but, you know, did not you know, experience this struggle, you know, and experience these histories has been, you know, an important part of my learning and, you know, sharing as well. So, you know, I think for me, grounding Indigenous and Black perspectives on this, it was like key, you know, and also, you know, the gender, you know, component of this is like threaded everywhere. You know, this is a lot of story of Indigenous women, women of color, you know, young people. Standing Rock was, you know, the struggles at Standing Rock were, came into public eye in part because there were Indigenous, you know, teenage girls that had a run that like made it very, you know, visible. And also LaDonna Allard, who, you know, made her home, you know, the place where the camps at Standing Rock were. And so, you know, I think that those perspectives are like absolutely central, you know, to thinking about like both the critique of what, you know, what are the problems, but then also how do we get out of them? How do we respond to them? How do we, you know, create cultures of community and solidarity? You know, when LaDonna Allard opened up her homestead and said, come, you know, she said, this is my home. You know, that Standing Rock is where my people were buried. This is a grave site. It's not a place, you know, to be flooded, you know, because of for energy. It is my home. And it can be, it will be your home. You know, if come to my home and we can, you know, do this work together. And, you know, that was, you know, a kind of amazing, you know, moment where people kind of responded to that call, you know, which isn't to say it wasn't complicated. There aren't fraught, you know, politics and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, it's very important to not romanticize movements. You know, there people come to them with their own kinds of, you know, issues and baggage. And, you know, it's really, you know, but it's through the struggle that you have to struggle, you know, and including like struggling in relations with each other. Dallas Goldtooth, who is an organizer in Keep It in the Ground, and he's a very key leader in Indigenous environmental justice. He was very active at Standing Rock, and his father, Tom Goldtooth, is the founder of Indigenous Environmental Network. He's also in a comic, an Indigenous comic with this group called the 1491s. You know, and that's obviously like a reference to 1492, right? And so they do a lot of like comedy. And so, you know, he has an interview that he did where he basically says, you know, there is no separation between the comedy I do and the, you know, organizing I do. You know, like comedy is how I process like I think the quote is like the batshit craziness like on the ground. Do you know what I mean? And so like the culture, you know, has to be a site where this stuff is worked through, and it has to be, you know, sometimes hopeful, sometimes satiric, sometimes, you know, mocking, sometimes angry, you know, but that's how people can sustain themselves instead of just sort of burning out and disappearing and just being like, you know, I can't do anything. So what's the hope, you know, in any of it? So sometimes I talk a very long time and I forget what the question was. So anyway.
No, that's great. Like you really walked us through this understanding of what the everyday looks like when you're sustaining a movement that lasts however many years or however many hundreds of years in this case, and what it means to incorporate these everyday processes and the range of emotions that come with it, the happiness, the laughter, the hope, alongside the struggle and this sustained process of resistance. Mm-hmm. I wonder if also then we could talk through how you conceptualize violence in this context, because within your conceptualization of violence, there's this capacity to bring together all these different movements and these different iterations of state violence that affect different groups and different communities in varied ways, but in ways where they can come together and connect over how they're all being implicated within violence as a system. So maybe you could speak a little bit to your understanding of slow violence as you walk us through it in the book, and also how you bring that back to your understanding of state violence.
Yes, that's a good question. You know, of course, slow violence comes from Rob Nixon. And Rob Nixon talks about slow violence as sort of the everyday, like, accretion. And, you know, it's like, I think it's called slow violence and environmentalism of the poor. It's really sort of a global South, you know, look at and the kind of normalization of systems of, you know, global hierarchy and how they play out in bodies in, you know, bodies and communities around the world. And so, you know, his idea of slow violence is so powerful and has been used by many, many people. I wanted to talk about it in relationship to fast violence, which I don't know if he comes up with this term or not, but the idea, and that's why I put Flint and the Central Valley together, because Flint in a lot of ways is exceptional. I mean, it's exceptional because there was a start point, because there was a state cover-up, you know, of the lead poisoning, you know, and because there was actual like actors and a moment where you could say, okay, well, there was a moment when the water privatization led to lead poisoning. Like there's a very clear, you know, narrative arc of like villains and victims. And that's counterposed, you know, so basically, you know, just a summary, you know, the state hid the lead poisoning that came as a result of a privatization attempt that came from sort of Republican-led, you know, administration that said, look, we can save money if we privatize this system, even though our public system was fine the way it was. And the when they did that, they basically, there was a thing that happened to the lead pipes and Flint, the water in Flint, basically was poisoned by lead. And it was a mass lead poisoning of like a city of 100,000 people that was covered up. And it's a majority poor, slightly majority African-American city in a state that, you know, where the racial and class politics are very much around, you know, sort of like suburban versus Black majority city, white Republicans, privatization proponents, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, you put that Flint case, which got like a ton of, you know, attention in the news and, you know, the water systems, you know, people had to like get all of their water by bottled water and so on. I put it against, you know, the Central Valley region of California where I am in, and there's a lot of different environmental and toxicity problems. There's water pollution from like arsenic and runoff from industrial agriculture. There's a like the worst air pollution in the US is in the Central Valley in these tiny farm worker towns. There's a lot of, there's so like air and pesticide and water pollution. There's also a high concentration of prisons, you know, in the Central Valley region. So in California, there's over, I think, 100,000 people who don't have access to clean water at like now. Like that's their everyday existence. So every time they need water, they have to go buy it, you know, and these folks are not rich, right? So, you know, so then I wanted to put these together because I wanted to think about like why one system is accepted as like an everyday reality, you know, as opposed to like this thing that, you know, is sort of shocking to people. So, you know, in Central Valley, you know, the idea of like having to get all of your water from bottled water is like the norm for many people from farm worker communities or in tiny towns that are not connected to water systems and so on. And again, they were engineered to be that way. So they were engineered by, you know, the government to sort of be unincorporated. So they will be right next to like a city and then deliberately not connected to the water system. You know, these are not like kind of accidents, like people kind of moved there and then, you know, et cetera. There's actually, you know, there's a lot of research about unincorporated communities like at by design and so on. So I was very interested in the idea of like slow violence and fast violence. And so, you know, something like lead poisoning, you know, is also connected to fast violence. You know, when I talk about police brutality and environmental violence in this other piece I wrote with my colleague, Lindsay Dillon, when we talk about Eric Garner and Freddie Gray, who are, you know, two of the hundreds of people of color, primarily Black and Latinx men who are killed and murdered by the police. And so Eric Garner had asthma. He was in New York, and Freddie Gray had extreme lead poisoning from a child. You know, so their deaths were galvanizing in the, you know, Black Lives Matter, anti-police brutality uprisings, but their bodies were already very vulnerable to the environmental and social violence because of their position as poor urban, you know, Black men of color. And so, you know, their violence, they die by fast violence, but they were already dying by slow violence, in other words. And so what I was really interested in is, you know, why some violence gets normalized as just the way it is, as opposed to like some is, you know, like outrageous. Do you know what I mean? Like, why is some, you know, concern for people and then others are just like, oh, well, you know, I was thinking about, you know, in the Central Valley, there's this place called Kettleman City, which there's been a very vibrant environmental justice movement for over 30 years. And it's the biggest PCB toxic facility west of the Mississippi. And a few years ago, there was a cleft palate controversy where, you know, 25%, I mean, it's a very small town. So there were a number of cleft palate births and a baby newborn deaths. And so the Kettleman activists said, you know, this is related to the, you know, facility. And there was a lot of organizing around it. And there was a State Department of Public Health, you know, report that was done, which basically said, you know, said, no, it had nothing to do with the, you know, facility, because Kettleman City is as polluted as every other small town in the Central Valley. Do you know what I mean? And so to me, that kind of the sort of cynicism around like, well, it's as polluted as every place else, so there's nothing special about it, you know, is the kind of acceptance of this politics of, you know, slow everyday violence. And so, you know, this is where, again, you know, environmental violence comes together with state violence. There is no difference, in other words. The state is dependent on producing safety and security for some at the expense of others. And I think that's a difficult thing if you grew up like not knowing that or not experiencing it. And this going back to like COVID and that kind of what's changed since then, definitely, you know, I live in California and we have terrible wildfires always, but there was one year where it just was like, you know, everybody was experiencing wildfires and COVID. So that feeling of being, and there was police organizing against police brutality. So there was like this, the summer where all this stuff was converging. And there was that sense of like, you couldn't go inside anywhere because of COVID and you couldn't go outside anywhere because of the wildfires, but you needed to be outside because of the protests. Do you know what I mean? And so, and I think that in a lot of ways, that idea of like, okay, feeling trapped is something that people of color and indigenous people have been living and dying under for such a long time. And it's only been in the last, you know, 5 years that, you know, people who were not directly impacted by this kind of violence can say, oh, this is what it feels like to feel like you have no control, that there are forces that are, you know, outside that are impacting your ability to like live healthfully and so on. And that feeling, you know, when it's channeled through the organizing, I think is like where it's like, that's where I have the hope. Do you know what I mean? But, you know, we need like to be analytic, but then also not be like, okay, well, everything is so overwhelming, so why bother? Do you know what I mean? And so I think that's where justice movements like come in. They say, yes, yes, this is big picture stuff. And yet, if we kind of say, okay, well, the state doesn't really need our labor anymore, or the state doesn't, you know, they've already taken our land and, you know, they still want more of it, or they still want to pollute more of it, you know, like, oh, well, do you know what I mean? Like that's environmental justice movements are saying, look, like you don't have the luxury of despair. You know, you show up, you know, you support. That's everybody's job because we're all vulnerable. You know, we may have been the canaries in the mine, you know, to use a mining metaphor, but everybody suffers when we feel that like, that kind of sense of like entrapment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the connections that you're making here and the connections that you're making in the book about these different forms of violence and how they're all entangled and how it is that in these moments of danger, when different communities are all trapped by these systems in ways that they can't escape, and therefore they experience what some communities, particularly Black and Indigenous people, have experienced all along. And there's mm-hmm. this shared sense of, oh, is this how this feels? That's mm-hmm. so powerful. And in your book, you say that the hashtag no DAPL solidarity meant offering bodies as a form of material support and as a witness to police and state violence. That's so powerful because that's where you put everything that you have on the line, saying that this environmental justice is very much about freedom, the way you conceptualize this. And everyone has to be free for it to actually be meaningful and for it to be freedom. And maybe in thinking also about what are the ways in which one can offer solidarity and what are the ways in which we can remember these different instances of state violence, maybe we can talk a little bit more about the practices that are underway in keeping these memories alive and these memories of environmental justice and these stories alive, right? Because storytelling as a practice is a big part of your narrative of how these movements come together. So could you speak more to what those practices are like?
Yeah, I mean, I think storytelling is really a key part of environmental justice movements. And in the book, I have this quote from Elizabeth Jean-Pierre, who is an environmental justice, climate justice leader that I've known for, 28 years. And she talks about how movements have to look like us, movements have to sound like us, they have to be joyful. You know, it can't just be like, middle class people in a room making policy. Like, that's not what moves people. Like, movements have to move people, they have to be, joyful and thoughtful and have to be a place where you want to show up. And it can't just be like, okay, here's another 1,000-page report about how, it's almost too late. Do you know what I mean? there has to be, I saw this quote, it said the best kind of, activism is like straddling the line between like hope and anger. And so, the movements, storytelling is a big part of the hopeful part of it, saying, look, our story matters. The state thinks our community doesn't matter. And we actually don't care what the state thinks, but because we know that we matter. We know that our stories are important. We share the story of our elders and so on. And so, just to give you an example of a project I'm just finishing up in Vallejo, I don't talk about this in the book, but it's something I'm working on now. I'm working with LaDonna Williams, who is an African-American environmental justice organizer in the Bay Area. And she, has been, doing work for a long time against PG&E and, in San Francisco, but now in Vallejo. And Vallejo is a poor city that, went bankrupt, and it has the oldest military base on the West, in the West, from like basically before statehood, so 1859. So it's like a city that's defined by sort of the military. And is highly toxic in the South Vallejo, which is the majority Black working class community. And there's also like a very, very horrific police murder problem, police murder pattern, in Vallejo. And so I worked with her and her organization, All Positives Possible, on a storytelling project. And what that project was, in part, was telling the stories of Black Vallejo, activists over time that have been fighting for justice. And some of that is justice, within the military, because the US military was deeply segregated during World War II. So, the military base, Mare Island, there's lots of, rioting against Black sailors. It's very close to where there was a big explosion in World War II, where, the Black segregated, Navy personnel who were loading the munitions, there was over 324 of them died, 200, the vast majority of them were Black sailors. And the sailors, refused to go back because of, this explosion that killed most of their, peers. And they were court-martialed, for basically military, not listening to orders. And so, there are all these layers of violence, violence by the military, violence by the police, violence by, the oil refineries, all this stuff. And so, the project that we are working on is recounting the stories of the elders, including people like Pat Dotson, who, is over definitely over 80, you know, talking about these moments, you know, and growing up and these sort of moments of hope and survival, you know, over time. So, you know, your storytelling is really important, because if you just are like, okay, these terrible things happened and all of this, you know, all of this stuff is like basically primed for you and your community to be dead, you know, like, how is that, what does that get you? Do you know what I mean? Like, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't move you very much. Do you know what I mean? But hearing the stories of, you know, Black elders and women who have been fighting for, you know, decades around all of these issues, you know, that's kind of beautiful, you know? So storytelling is really, really important. And I think, you know, there's a lot of ways in which, you know, I mean, I guess it depends on what world you live in, but, you know, if you do environmental work, there's a lot of ways in which environmental work gets fetishized as environmental science or environmental policy. And the storytelling component is often seen as kind of, it's not real, it's not important, it's not like, you know, empirical. But, you know, I don't think, A, I don't think that's true. And B, I would argue that it's actually more important, because why else would people care? You know, I mean, we have all the data in the world about climate change and parts, you know, and parts per million or in diesel. And, you know, there's a lot of empirical documentation, not just around climate, but around all kinds of, you know, issues, plastics pollution, you know, toxicity. And that does not move people. You know, what moves people is stories and visions of what can and should be.
So you were talking about what moves people. It's the stories that moves people.
It has to be, because the science isn't. Do you know what I mean? You know? I mean, not when it comes to environmental stuff.
Yeah. I hear you. I see where you're locating in these emotions and these sets of stories that actually push people into action. And motivate them to come together. That's so important and such a core part of environmental justice. And another thing that you talk about in the book about what it is that moves people is this idea of home and what it means to claim a particular place as home, despite, you know, evidence of that place as overly polluted, despite the fact that that is a space of extreme environmental violence. And so maybe, could I ask you to go a little bit deeper into this question of home and what that means in the context of these movements?
That's a really important question. And I really struggled with it, in part because if you understand, you know, Indigenous relations to home, it is different than, you know, other claims to home and homeland, you know? So when I was struck by their Robert Warrior, who was who is an important Indigenous scholar, and he was past president of the American Studies Association, and he had a keynote that called Home Not Home, and so, you know, he talks about the idea of home and how for Indigenous people, you know, it's different than people claiming home who are not Indigenous. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, as someone who is not Indigenous, but, you know, a descendant of immigrants and refugees, you know, we have a different relationship to that, to the US. And so I'm trying to be very careful when I think about home to take the Indigenous perspectives around home and settler colonialism, critiques of settler colonialism really seriously. And I think it's really easy, you know, for people who are, you know, immigrants, especially, or descendants of immigrants, to be like, okay, well, that's not my problem. You know, my family came, like, you know, I don't know. I've heard this from people who are like, well, my family came after slavery ended, so why is this my problem? You know, my family succeeded because we did X, Y, or Z. Do you know what I mean? And so, you know, and, you know, personally, you know, that was definitely a narrative that was like kind of pushed upon me. And it's part of the broader culture, right? And so Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, an important Indigenous scholar, you know, just wrote a book called, you know, Not a Nation of Immigrants, you know? And so it's really important, again, to ground the idea of home, understanding that home is not the same for descendants of settlers, immigrants and refugees, and those who, you know, were forcibly brought to the U.S. Like, people have a different relationship to home because of their trajectory around it. And so I think, you know, in part, like, you know, refugees have a different relationship of home too, because, you know, a lot of times that has to do with like the impact of US foreign policy and militarization and so on. So they have been forced out of their homes. And so, you know, immigrants and refugees have different relationships to each other. And so I think for me, you know, I'm not like attached to like the idea of home as a stable place. And that's what, you know, Robert Warrior argues, you know, that the idea of home, not home, is something that has to be kind of held together. Home cannot be like a comfortable place where everything is always the same, you know, or, you know, romanticized and so on, which is actually, you know, I think goes back to the idea of like trying to escape an idea of permanence and domination. Like, home is where, you know, there is stability and comfort. You know, I think that's an illusion, you know. At the same time, you know, I think that there is, we have to, you know, honor, you know, treaties to land rights that, you know, have been taken, and that like indigenous relationships to home and homelands is absolutely fundamental, especially like in this, you know, current political moment, and we, you know, with the Supreme Court basically chipping away indigenous land rights in addition to like all other kinds of rights, you know. But I think part of the forces of political domination are around this like idea of home as a fixed place of safety, you know, this kind of like island of safety while the world kind of falls apart, you know what I mean? Like, we can have home, you know, on Mars, you know, like rich people can just escape their problems through, you know, technology or money. But, you know, the reality is nobody is safe from anything ever, right? And so what can ground us in the face of that lack of safety? And I think for me, you know, that idea, like, home has to be both grounded but also not fixed. Does that make sense? I don't know. I'm a little bit like kind of, I don't talk about this in the book. It's just things I've been thinking about since writing the book.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes a lot of sense. And I think we can also talk a little bit more about the projects you're working on, or I was going to ask you anyway, what your projects are right now and what it is that you continue to work on. So before we go into that, maybe I can also ask you, how capaciously are you thinking about this concept of home? Because when you're not just talking about home, or you're not just talking about claims in this book, just in the context of land, right? Like, there's a whole section where you talk about the indigenous approach towards these movements and the positioning of indigenous people as water protectors. And I wonder how beyond human or what multi-species angles there are in your conceptualization of home, or perhaps in your future projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is why, you know, at Standing Rock and, you know, other indigenous movements against, you know, oils and pipelines, you know, there's this idea that like, this is not just land that can be exploitable. You know, this is not just resources that have like, you know, material value, you know, that, but that's why, you know, LaDonna Allard said, look, this is where my family is. And you don't do things to people's graves. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't. And that's a kind of, I think, you know, many cultures, you know, honor their dead. Do you know what I mean? And so, you know, it's both multi-species, but also multi-temporal, you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's home is a lot of things. It's land. It's also community. It's memory. It's connection. It's so many things, as you know, as well. And I told you this, but you know, my mother has terminal cancer right now, and one of the things that, you know, she's a Buddhist, and I've been trying to understand, you know, what the Buddhist conception of death, you know, is. And you know, somebody said it was like beingness and nothingness. You know, but it's actually, you know, if it's not like there isn't an end, you know, there's just, you're connected, your physical body is in here, but, you know, there's a kind of, you know, there isn't like loss in sort of a Judeo-Christian kind of model, you know. And so, you know, I think my mother, when, you know, she almost died in the hospital, and she said, you know, in like, I want to go home, you know. And, you know, I said, oh, do you mean the family home? And she's like, no, I want to go home, you know. And I am still kind of like processing what that means, you know. And I said, you know, are you scared? And she said, no, I'm not scared. I just want to go home, you know. So home is like a really important concept, but I think it can mean many things. It can mean spiritual home. It can be, you know, the idea that like our ancestors are with us, you know, the you know, the indigenous idea of like seven generations, like it's in the past, it's in the future. You think seven generations behind, you think seven generations ahead. You know, it's not looking at the temporality of like capitalism, which is like, you know, what the balance sheet looks like in 5 years or whatever. What's your payout so you can like basically take the money and run? Do you know what I mean? The temporality, the value system, everything is just completely different, you know? So if you think of your, you know, the earth as your home or the land as your home, you're not going to shit on it. Do you know what I mean? You're not going to like abuse it. You don't do that, you know? And I think that that is an ethic that is a very beautiful one. And, you know, that necessarily includes all species and peoples and, you know, air, land, water, you know, spirits. Do you know what I mean? It's not just, you know, what you can know and, you know, empirically, and what you can like the gold you can like stuff in your pockets. Do you know what I mean? Your Bitcoin or whatever. Do you know what I mean? It's like a much more like broad idea of life and death and, you know, and like the cycles of them, you know, in a way that sort of, you know, protects itself over the long haul, do you know what I mean? As opposed to just this extraction model that's like, let's just do this, pick up and go and do it someplace else. You know, that's what colonialism and capitalism is. You know, let's just take, exploit, destroy, leave, find someplace else to do the same thing. Do you know what I mean? And if we have a different relationship to home that's like, you know, based on like the ways people have been living and surviving and dying, you know, we have a different relationship to the resources and the planet and the people than the ones that we have been taught to value. So I don't know.
Thank you, Julie. That was, thank you so much for sharing that. And that was such a, I'm in awe of your capacity to kind of suture in hope and optimism and depth in thinking about relations and in thinking about home and in thinking about feelings and emotions and what it means to guard the land and the soil and see these things as not just resources, but as a part of our existence and a part of who we are and what we need to protect and the futures we're working towards. So that was really well put in a very generous way and generative way of thinking about home. Maybe a final question maybe would be, I guess, what can we expect to read of your work next? What are you working on in terms of things that we can read, a book or another project perhaps?
I mean, until I pass, and I don't know when that will be, the only thing I'm working on, I mean, I've been working on environmental justice, like different forms of it for like 30 years. And, you know, of course, environmental justice and climate justice are all I'm going to do until I go, you know, in part because I think, you know, the environmental justice and climate justice, you know, are what I know, what I care about, what I love, what I'm afraid, you know, for, and so on. And so, you know, I am working on a book on climate justice as freedom, in part because I think, you know, I went through a phase where I was really thinking about violence and death. And then I just had to shift and I said, okay, well, I can't always be talking about environmental violence and death. You know, this is part of the shift, you know, myself of being like, okay, well, what's the thing that movements are working for, you know, and part of it is this idea of freedom. And, you know, what the future looks like, that is not just about like fighting in a negative sense, And so, you know, the work on climate justice as freedom, I really like Libby Onker. She wrote a book about ugly freedoms, where she talks about, you know, the idea of freedom as being, you know, basically dominated in the US political landscape as, you know, like the freedom to not wear a mask, or the freedom to, you know, buy yourself to safety, or, you know, like an individualist consumption based, you know, sovereignty freedom. And what social movements do, she argues, and, you know, I'm sort of picking up, you know, her arguments in that book, is that, you know, social movements and climate justice movements are saying, no, freedom is not around individualism, it's around community. Freedom is not about ownership, it's about, you know, care. Freedom is not about this, it's about these other things, you know. So I think, you know, this new book is really kind of talking about climate justice as a freedom struggle, you know, and what does that look like? And what are the visions, you know, that are regenerative and beautiful? Because that's what we need, because the earth and the world, you know, and people and communities, you know, are beautiful. And, you know, it's just the systems don't support that. So how do we shift so that we are building back the world as a beautiful place, you know? Sometimes I'm in like the redwoods and I just look up and I'm like, oh, the world is beautiful. And I don't mean, you know, to fetishize like nature as like a place where people are not, and, you know, all that stuff, but the world is a beautiful place. And, you know, why are we like trashing it and having the oceans be covered in plastic? Do you know what I mean? And so, you know, climate justice, I think movements are, they fight the bad things and they envision the good ones always simultaneously. So any work I do from now on will be, you know, always, I mean, it always has been, but, you know, very focused on this idea of climate justice as a beautiful movement for freedom. So,
yeah, thank you. I think that's a wonderful note for us to end on. And thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview. And for those listening, I cannot recommend enough that you pick up a copy of Environmental Justice in a Moment of Danger and read the book while we await what it is that you publish next.
Last thing I was gonna say was that the royalties for this book go to two of the organizations that I write about in the book. So, you know, a lot of, you know, this is like about, you know, how do you practice this on an everyday front? Do you know what I mean? Like, how do you share the knowledge and the resources and sort of direct out and build? You know, it's always about growing and building things. It's not about your own ego and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? So everything I do is always in response to movements. It's to build movements, and it's for movements. So anyway, thank you for the space to talk about this. I appreciate your flexibility.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for also telling us about that. I really appreciate your commitment to praxis as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye.